been so to some extent to this day. The Old Testament, the Talmud, and many, though not all, rabbis, maintained that the life of a Jew is more valuable than the life of a Gentile, which is why, for example, Jews are allowed to desecrate the Sabbath in order to save a Jew from death, but are forbidden to do so merely in order to save a Gentile. Babylonian Talmud, Yoma chapter 84, verse 2. Some Jewish sages have argued that even the famous commandment, "Love your neighbor as yourself," refers only to Jews, and that there is absolutely no commandment to love Gentiles. Indeed, the original text from Leviticus says, "Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your people, but love your neighbor as yourself." Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, which raises the suspicion that "your neighbor" refers only to members of your people. This suspicion is greatly strengthened by the fact that the Bible commands Jews to exterminate certain people, such as the Amalekites and the Canaanites. "Do not leave alive a single soul," decrees the Holy Book. "Completely destroy them, the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you." Deuteronomy chapter 20, verses 16 and 17. This is one of the first recorded instances in human history when genocide was presented as a binding religious duty. It was only the Christians who selected some choice morsels of the Jewish moral code, turned them into universal commandments, and spread them throughout the world. Indeed, Christianity split from Judaism precisely on this account. While many Jews to this day believe that the so-called chosen people are closer to God than other nations are, the founder of Christianity, the Apostle Paul, stipulated in his famous epistle to the Galatians that "there is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus." Galatians chapter 3, verse 28. And we must again emphasize that despite the enormous impact of Christianity, this was definitely not the first time a human preached a universal ethic. The Bible is far from being the exclusive font of human morality, and luckily so, given the many racist, misogynist, and homophobic attitudes it contains. Confucius, Lao Tzu, Buddha, and Mahavira established universal ethical codes long before Paul and Jesus, without knowing anything about the land of Canaan or the prophets of Israel. Confucius taught that every person must love others as he loves himself, about 500 years before Rabbi Hillel the Elder said that this was the essence of the Torah. And at a time when Judaism still mandated the sacrifice of animals and the systematic extermination of entire human populations, Buddha and Mahavira were already instructing their followers to avoid harming not only all human beings, but any sentient being whatsoever, even including insects. It therefore makes absolutely no sense to credit Judaism and its Christian and Muslim offspring with the creation of human morality. The birth of bigotry. What about monotheism, then? Doesn't Judaism at least deserve special praise for pioneering the belief in a single God, which was unparalleled anywhere else in the world, even if this belief was then spread to the four corners of the earth by Christians and Muslims more than Jews? We can quibble even about that, since the first clear evidence for monotheism comes from the religious revolution of Pharaoh Akhenaten around 1350 BCE, and documents such as the Mesha Stele, erected by the Moabite king Mesha, indicate that the religion of biblical Israel was not all that different from the religion of neighboring kingdoms such as Moab. Mesha describes his great god Chemosh in almost the same way that the Old Testament describes Yahweh. But the real problem with the idea that Judaism contributed monotheism to the world is that this is hardly something to be proud of. From an ethical perspective, monotheism was arguably one of the worst ideas in human history. Monotheism did little to improve the moral standards of humans. Do you really think Muslims are inherently more ethical than Hindus, just because Muslims believe in a single god, while Hindus believe in many gods? Were Christian conquistadores more ethical than pagan Native American tribes? What monotheism undoubtedly did was to make many people far more intolerant than before, thereby contributing to the spread of religious persecutions and holy wars. Polytheists found it perfectly acceptable that different people worshipped different gods and performed diverse rites and rituals. They rarely, if ever, fought, persecuted, or killed people just because of their religious beliefs. Monotheists, in contrast, believed that their god was the only god and that he demanded universal obedience. Consequently, as Christianity and Islam spread around the world, so did the incidence of crusades, jihads, inquisitions, and religious discrimination. Compare, for example, the attitude of Emperor Asoka of India in the 3rd century BCE to that of the Christian emperors of the late Roman Empire. Emperor Asoka ruled an empire teeming with myriad religions, sects, and gurus. He gave himself the official titles of Beloved of the Gods and The King Who Regards Everyone with Affection. Sometime around 250 BCE, he issued an imperial edict of tolerance that proclaimed, Beloved of the gods, the king who regards everyone with affection, honors both ascetics and the householders of all religions, and values that there should be growth in the essentials of all religions. Growth in essentials can be done in different ways, but all of them have as their root restraint in speech, that is, not praising one's own religion or condemning the religion of others without good cause. Whoever praises his own religion due to excessive devotion and condemns others with the thought, let me glorify my own religion, only harms his own religion. Therefore, contact between religions is good. One should listen to and respect the doctrines professed by others. Beloved of the gods, the king who regards everyone with affection, desires that all should be well learned in the good doctrines of other religions. 500 years later, the late Roman Empire was as diverse as Asoka's India. But when Christianity took over, the emperors adopted a very different approach to religion. Beginning with Constantine the Great and his son Constantius II, the emperors closed all non-Christian temples and forbade so-called pagan rituals on pain of death. The persecution culminated under the reign of Emperor Theodosius, whose name means given by God, who, in 391, issued the Theodosian Decrees, which effectively made all religions except Christianity and Judaism illegal. Judaism, too, was persecuted in numerous ways, but it remained legal to practice it. According to the new laws, one could be executed even for worshipping Jupiter or Mithras in the privacy of one's own home. As part of their campaign to cleanse the empire of all infidel heritage, the Christian emperors also suppressed the Olympic Games. Having been celebrated for more than 1,000 years, the last ancient Olympiad was held sometime in the late 4th or early 5th century. Of course, not all monotheist rulers were as intolerant as Theodosius, whereas numerous rulers rejected monotheism without adopting the broad-minded policies of Asoka. Nevertheless, by insisting that there is no god but our god, the monotheist idea tended to encourage bigotry. Jews would do well to downplay their part in disseminating this dangerous meme, and let the Christians and Muslims carry the blame for it. Jewish physics, Christian biology. Only in the 19th and 20th centuries do we see Jews make an extraordinary contribution to humankind as a whole, through their outsized role in modern science. In addition to such well-known names as Einstein and Freud, about 20% of all Nobel Prize laureates in science have been Jews, though Jews constitute less than 0.2% of the world's population. But it should be stressed that this has been a contribution of individual Jews rather than of Judaism as a religion or a culture. Most of the important Jewish scientists of the past 200 years acted outside the Jewish religious sphere. Indeed, Jews began to make their remarkable contribution to science only once they had abandoned the yeshiva in favor of the laboratory. Prior to 1800, the Jewish impact on science was limited. Naturally enough, Jews played no significant role in the progress of science in China, in India, or in the Maya civilization. In Europe and the Middle East, some Jewish thinkers such as Maimonides had considerable influence on their Gentile colleagues, but the overall Jewish impact was more or less proportional to their demographic weight. During the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, Judaism was hardly instrumental to the outbreak of the scientific revolution. Except for Spinoza, who was excommunicated for his trouble by the Jewish community, you can hardly name a single Jew who was critical to the birth of modern physics, chemistry, biology, or the social sciences. We don't know what Einstein's ancestors were doing in the days of Galileo and Newton, but in all likelihood they were far more interested in studying the Talmud than in studying the properties of light. The great change occurred only in the 19th and 20th centuries, when secularization and the Jewish Enlightenment caused many Jews to adopt the worldview and lifestyle of their Gentile neighbors. Jews then began to join the universities and research centers of countries such as Germany, France, and the United States. Jewish scholars brought from the ghettos and shtetls important cultural legacies. The central value of education in Jewish culture was one of the main reasons for the extraordinary success of Jewish scientists. Other factors included the desire of a persecuted minority to prove its worth, and the barriers that prevented talented Jews from advancement in more anti-Semitic institutions, such as the army and the state administration. Yet, while Jewish scientists brought with them from the yeshivas strong discipline and a deep faith in the value of knowledge, they did not bring any helpful baggage of concrete ideas and insights. Einstein was Jewish, but the theory of relativity wasn't Jewish physics. What does faith in the sacredness of the Torah have to do with the insight that energy equals mass multiplied by the speed of light squared? For the sake of comparison, Darwin was a Christian and even began his studies at Cambridge, intending to become an Anglican priest. Does it imply that the theory of evolution is a Christian theory? It would be ridiculous to list the theory of relativity as a Jewish contribution to humankind, just as it would be ridiculous to credit Christianity with the theory of evolution. Similarly, it is hard to see anything particularly Jewish about the invention of the process for synthesizing ammonia by Fritz Haber, Nobel Prize in Chemistry, 1918, the discovery of the antibiotic streptomycin by Selman Waksman, Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine, 1952, or the discovery of quasicrystals by Dan Schechtman, Nobel Prize in Chemistry, 2011. In the case of scholars from the humanities and social sciences, such as Freud, their Jewish heritage probably had a deeper impact on their insights. Yet, even in these cases, the discontinuities are more glaring than the surviving links. Freud's views about the human psyche were very different from those of Rabbi Joseph Caro or Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and he did not discover the Oedipus complex by carefully perusing the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. To summarize, although the Jewish emphasis on learning probably made an important contribution to the exceptional success of Jewish scientists, it was Gentile thinkers who laid the groundwork for the achievements of Einstein, Haber, and Freud. The scientific revolution wasn't a Jewish project, and Jews found their place in it when they moved from the yeshivas to the universities. Indeed, the Jewish habit of seeking the answers to all questions by reading ancient texts was a significant obstacle to Jewish integration into the world of modern science, where answers come from observations and experiments. If there was anything about the Jewish religion itself that necessarily leads to scientific breakthroughs, why is it that between 1905 and 1933, 10 secular German Jews won Nobel Prizes in chemistry, medicine, and physics, but during the same period, not a single ultra-Orthodox Jew, or a single Bulgarian or Yemenite Jew, won any Nobel Prize? Lest I be suspected of being a self-hating Jew or an anti-Semite, I would like to emphasize that I am not saying Judaism is a particularly evil or benighted religion. All I am saying is that it wasn't particularly important to the history of humankind. For many centuries, Judaism was the humble religion of a small, persecuted minority that preferred to read and contemplate rather than to conquer faraway countries and burn heretics at the stake. Anti-Semites usually think that Jews are very important. Anti-Semites imagine that the Jews control the world, or the banking system, or at least the media, and that they are to blame for everything, from global warming to the 9/11 attacks. Such anti-Semitic paranoia is as ludicrous as Jewish megalomania. Jews may be a very interesting people, but when you look at the big picture, you must realize that they have had a very limited impact on the world. Throughout history, humans have created hundreds of different religions and sects. A handful of them, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Confucianism, and Buddhism, influenced billions of people, not always for the best. The vast majority of creeds, such as the Bon religion, the Yoruba religion, and the Jewish religion, had a far smaller impact. Personally, I like the idea of descending not from brutal world conquerors, but from insignificant people who seldom poked their noses into other people's business. Many religions praise the value of humility, but then imagine themselves to be the most important thing in the universe. They mix calls for personal meekness with blatant collective arrogance. Humans of all creeds would do well to take humility more seriously. And among all forms of humility, perhaps the most important is to have humility before God. Whenever they talk of God, humans all too often profess abject self-effacement, but then use the name of God to lord it over their brethren. 13. God. Don't take the name of God in vain. Does God exist? That depends on which God you have in mind, the cosmic mystery or the worldly lawgiver. Sometimes when people talk about God, they talk about a grand and awesome enigma about which we know absolutely nothing. We invoke this mysterious God to explain the deepest riddles of the cosmos. Why is there something rather than nothing? What shaped the fundamental laws of physics? What is consciousness, and where does it come from? We do not know the answers to these questions, and we give our ignorance the grand name of God. The most fundamental characteristic of this mysterious God is that we cannot say anything concrete about him. This is the God of the philosophers, the God we talk about when we sit around a campfire late at night and wonder what life is all about. On other occasions, people see God as a stern and worldly lawgiver, about whom we know only too much. We know exactly what he thinks about fashion, food, sex, and politics, and we invoke this angry man in the sky to justify a million regulations, decrees, and conflicts. He gets upset when women wear short-sleeved shirts, when two men have sex with each other, or when teenagers masturbate. Some people say he does not like us to ever drink alcohol, whereas according to others, he positively demands that we drink wine every Friday night or every Sunday morning. Entire libraries have been written to explain in the minutest details exactly what he wants and what he dislikes. The most fundamental characteristic of this worldly lawgiver is that we can say extremely concrete things about him. This is the God of the Crusaders and jihadists, of the Inquisitors, misogynists, and homophobes. This is the God we talk about when we stand around a burning pyre, hurling stones and abuses at the heretics being grilled there. When the faithful are asked whether God really exists, they often begin by talking about the enigmatic mysteries of the universe and the limits of human understanding. "Science cannot explain the Big Bang," they exclaim, "so that must be God's doing." Yet, like a magician fooling an audience by imperceptibly replacing one card with another, the faithful quickly replace the cosmic mystery with the worldly lawgiver. After giving the name of God to the unknown secrets of the cosmos, they then use this to somehow condemn bikinis and divorce. "We do not understand the Big Bang. Therefore, you must cover your hair in public and vote against gay marriage." Not only is there no logical connection between the two, but they are in fact contradictory. The deeper the mysteries of the universe, the less likely it is that whatever is responsible for them gives a damn about female dress codes or human sexual behavior. The missing link between the cosmic mystery and the worldly lawgiver is usually provided through some holy book. The book is full of the most trifling regulations, but is nevertheless attributed to the cosmic mystery. The creator of space and time supposedly composed it, but he bothered to enlighten us mainly about some arcane temple rituals and food taboos. In truth, we don't have any evidence whatsoever that the Bible or the Quran or the Book of Mormon or the Vedas or any other holy book was composed by the force that determined that energy equals mass multiplied by the speed of light squared, and that protons are 1,837 times more massive than electrons. To the best of our scientific knowledge, all of these sacred texts were written by imaginative Homo sapiens. They are just stories invented by our ancestors in order to legitimize social norms and political structures. I personally never cease to wonder about the mystery of existence. But I have never understood what it has to do with the niggling laws of Judaism, Christianity, or Hinduism. These laws were certainly very helpful in establishing and maintaining the social order for thousands of years. But in that, they are not fundamentally different from the laws of secular states and institutions. The third of the biblical Ten Commandments instructs humans never to make wrongful use of the name of God. Many understand this in a childish way, as a prohibition on uttering the explicit name of God, as in the famous Monty Python scene, "If you say Jehovah." Perhaps the deeper meaning of this commandment is that we should never use the name of God to justify our political interests, our economic ambitions, or our personal hatreds. People hate somebody and say, "God hates him." People covet a piece of land and say, "God wants it." The world would be a much better place if we followed the third commandment more devotedly. You want to wage war on your neighbors and steal their land? Leave God out of it and find yourself some other excuse. When all is said and done, it is a matter of semantics. When I use the word God, I think of the God of the Islamic State, of the Crusades, of the Inquisition, and of the "God hates fags" banners. When I think of the mystery of existence, I prefer to use other words so as to avoid confusion. And unlike the God of the Islamic State and the Crusades, who cares a lot about names and above all about his most holy name, the mystery of existence doesn't care an iota what names we apes give it. Godless ethics. Of course, the cosmic mystery doesn't help us at all in maintaining the social order. People often argue that we must believe in a God that gave some very concrete laws to humans, or else morality will disappear and society will collapse into primeval chaos. It is certainly true that belief in gods was vital to various social orders, and that it sometimes had positive consequences. Indeed, the very same religions that inspire hate and bigotry in some people inspire love and compassion in others. For example, in the early 1960s, the Methodist minister Ted McIlvenna became aware of the plight of LGBT people in his community. He began exploring the situation of gays and lesbians in society in general, and in May 1964 convened a pioneering three-day dialogue between clergymen and gay and lesbian activists at the White Memorial Retreat Center in California. The participants subsequently set up the Council on Religion and the Homosexual, which, in addition to the activists, included Methodist, Episcopal, Lutheran, and United Church of Christ ministers. This was the first American organization to dare use the word homosexual in its official title. In the following years, CRH activities ranged from organizing costume parties to taking legal actions against unjust discrimination and persecution. The CRH became the seed of the gay rights movement in California. Reverend McIlvenna and the other men of God who joined him were well aware of the biblical injunctions against homosexuality, but they thought that it was more important to be true to the compassionate spirit of Christ than to the strict word of the Bible. Yet, though gods can inspire us to act compassionately, religious faith is not a necessary condition for moral behavior. The idea that we need a supernatural being to make us act morally assumes that there is something unnatural about morality. But why? Morality of some kind is natural. All social mammals, from chimpanzees to rats, have ethical codes that limit behavior like theft and murder. Among humans, morality is present in all societies, even though not all of them believe in the same God or in any God. Christians act with charity even without believing in the Hindu pantheon. Muslims value honesty, despite rejecting the divinity of Christ, and secular countries such as Denmark and the Czech Republic aren't more violent than devout countries such as Iran and Pakistan. Morality doesn't mean following divine commands. It means reducing suffering. Therefore, in order to act morally, you don't need to believe in any myth or story. You just need to develop a deep appreciation of suffering. If you really understand how an action causes unnecessary suffering to yourself or to others, you will naturally abstain from it. People nevertheless murder, rape, and steal because they have only a superficial appreciation of the misery this causes. They are fixated on satisfying their immediate lust or greed without concern for the impact on others, or even for the long-term impact on themselves. Even inquisitors who deliberately inflict as much pain as possible on their victim usually use various desensitizing and dehumanizing techniques in order to distance themselves from what they are doing. You might object that every human naturally seeks to avoid feeling miserable, but why would a human care about the misery of others unless some god demands it? One obvious answer is that humans are social animals, and therefore their happiness depends to a very large extent on their relations with others. Without love, friendship, and community, who could be happy? If you live a lonely, self-centered life, you are almost guaranteed to be miserable. So, at the very least, to be happy, you need to care about your family, your friends, and your community members. What, then, about complete strangers? Why not murder strangers and take their possessions to enrich myself and my tribe? Many thinkers have constructed elaborate social theories explaining why, in the long run, such behavior is counterproductive. You would not like to live in a society where strangers are routinely robbed and murdered. Not only would you be in constant danger, but you would lack the benefit of things like commerce, which depends on trust between strangers. Merchants don't usually visit dens of thieves. That's how secular theoreticians from ancient China to modern Europe have justified the golden rule of don't do to others what you would not like them to do to you. Yet we do not really need such complex, long-term theories to find a natural basis for universal compassion. Forget about commerce for a moment. On a much more immediate level, hurting others always hurts me too. Every violent act in the world begins with a violent desire in somebody's mind, which disturbs that person's own peace and happiness before it disturbs the peace and happiness of anyone else. Thus, people seldom steal unless they first develop a lot of greed and envy in their minds. People don't usually murder unless they first generate anger and hatred. Emotions such as greed, envy, anger, and hatred are very unpleasant. You cannot experience joy and harmony when you are boiling with anger or envy. Long before you murder anyone, your anger has already killed your own peace of mind. Indeed, you might keep boiling with anger for years without ever actually murdering the object of your hatred, in which case you haven't hurt anyone else, but you have nevertheless hurt yourself. It is therefore your natural self-interest, and not the command of some god, that should induce you to do something about your anger. If you were completely free of anger, you would feel far better than if you murdered an obnoxious enemy. For some people, a strong belief in a compassionate God that commands us to turn the other cheek may help in curbing anger. That's been an enormous contribution of religious belief to the peace and harmony of the world. Unfortunately, for other people, religious belief actually stokes and justifies their anger, especially if someone dares to insult their God or ignores his wishes. So the value of the lawgiver God ultimately depends on the behavior of his devotees. If they act well, they can believe anything they like. Similarly, the value of religious rites and sacred places depends on the type of feelings and behaviors they inspire. If visiting a temple makes people experience peace and harmony, that's wonderful. But if a particular temple causes violence and conflict, what do we need it for? It is clearly a dysfunctional temple. Just as it is pointless to fight over a sick tree that produces thorns rather than fruits, it is also pointless to fight over a defective temple that produces enmity rather than harmony. Not visiting any temples and not believing in any god is also a viable option. As the last few centuries have proved, we don't need to invoke God's name in order to live a moral life. Secularism can provide us with all the values we need. 14. Secularism. Acknowledge your shadow. What does it mean to be secular? Secularism is sometimes defined as the negation of religion, and secular people are therefore characterized by what they don't believe and don't do. According to this definition, secular people do not believe in any gods or angels, do not go to churches and temples, and do not perform rites and rituals. As such, the secular world appears to be hollow, nihilistic, and amoral, an empty box waiting to be filled with something. Few people would adopt such a negative identity. Self-professing secularists view secularism in a very different way. For them, secularism is a very positive and active worldview, defined by a coherent code of values rather than by opposition to this or that religion. In fact, many of the secular values are shared by various religious traditions. Unlike some sects that insist they have a monopoly over all wisdom and goodness, one of the chief characteristics of secular people is that they claim no such monopoly. They don't think that morality and wisdom came down from heaven in one particular place and time. Rather, they view morality and wisdom as the natural legacy of all humans. Therefore, it is only to be expected that at least some values would pop up in human societies all over the world, and would be common to Muslims, Christians, Hindus, and atheists. Religious leaders often present their followers with a stark either-or choice. Either you are Muslim or you are not. And if you are Muslim, you should reject all other doctrines. In contrast, secular people are comfortable with multiple hybrid identities. As far as secularism is concerned, you can go on calling yourself a Muslim and continue to pray to Allah, eat halal food, and make the Hajj to Mecca, yet also be a good member of secular society, provided you adhere to the secular ethical code. This ethical code, which is in fact accepted by millions of Muslims, Christians, and Hindus, as well as by atheists, enshrines the values of truth, compassion, equality, freedom, courage, and responsibility. It forms the foundation of modern scientific and democratic institutions. Like all ethical codes, the secular code is an ideal to aspire to rather than a social reality. Just as Christian societies and Christian institutions often deviate from the Christian ideal, so too secular societies and institutions often fall far short of the secular ideal. Medieval France was a self-proclaimed Christian kingdom, but it dabbled in all kinds of not very Christian activities. Just ask the downtrodden peasantry. Modern France is a self-proclaimed secular state, but from the days of Robespierre onward, it took some troubling liberties with the very definition of liberty. Just ask women. That does not mean that secular people, in France or elsewhere, lack a moral compass or an ethical commitment. It just means that it is not easy to live up to an ideal. The secular ideal. What, then, is the secular ideal? The most important secular commitment is to the truth, which is based on observation and evidence, rather than on mere faith. Secularists strive not to confuse truth with belief. If you have a very strong belief in some story, that may tell us a lot of interesting things about your psychology, about your childhood, and about your brain structure. But it does not prove that the story is true. Often, strong beliefs are needed precisely when the story isn't true. In addition, secularists do not sanctify any group, person, or book as if it and it alone has sole custody of the truth. Instead, secular people sanctify the truth wherever it may reveal itself, in ancient fossilized bones, in images of far-off galaxies, in tables of statistical data, or in the writings of various human traditions. This commitment to the truth underlies modern science, which has enabled humankind to crack the atom, decipher the genome, track the evolution of life, and understand the history of humanity itself. The other chief commitment of secular people is to compassion. Secular ethics relies not on obeying the edicts of this or that god, but rather on a deep appreciation of suffering. For example, secular people abstain from murder not because some ancient book forbids it, but because killing inflicts immense suffering on sentient beings. There is something deeply troubling and dangerous about people who avoid killing just because God says so. Such people are motivated by obedience rather than compassion, and what will they do if they come to believe that their God commands them to kill heretics, witches, adulterers, or foreigners? Of course, in the absence of absolute divine commandments, secular ethics often face difficult dilemmas. What happens when the same action hurts one person but helps another? Is it ethical to levy high taxes on the rich in order to help the poor? To wage a bloody war in order to remove a brutal dictator? To allow an unlimited number of refugees into our country? When secular people encounter such dilemmas, they do not ask, "What does God command?" Rather, they carefully weigh the feelings of all concerned parties, examine a wide range of observations and possibilities, and search for a middle path that will cause as little harm as possible. Consider, for example, attitudes toward sexuality. How do secular people decide whether to endorse or oppose rape, homosexuality, bestiality, and incest? By examining feelings. Rape is obviously unethical, not because it breaks some divine commandment, but because it hurts people. In contrast, a loving relationship between two men harms no one, so there is no reason to forbid it. What about bestiality? I have participated in numerous private and public debates about gay marriage, and all too often some wise guy asks, "If marriage between two men is okay, why not allow marriage between a man and a goat?" From a secular perspective, the answer is obvious. Healthy relationships require emotional, intellectual, and even spiritual depth. A marriage lacking such depth will make you frustrated, lonely, and psychologically stunted. Whereas two men can certainly satisfy the emotional, intellectual, and spiritual needs of each other, a relationship with a goat cannot. Therefore, if you see marriage as an institution aimed at promoting human well-being, as secular people do, you would not dream of even raising such a bizarre question. Only people who see marriage as some kind of miraculous ritual might do so. So, how about relations between a father and his daughter? Both are humans, so what's wrong with that? Well, numerous psychological studies have demonstrated that such relations inflict immense and usually irreparable harm on the child. In addition, they reflect and intensify destructive tendencies in the parent. Evolution has shaped the psyche of Homo sapiens in such a way that romantic bonds just don't mix well with parental bonds. Therefore, you don't need God or the Bible to oppose incest. You just need to read the relevant psychological studies. This is the deep reason secular people cherish scientific truth, not in order to satisfy their curiosity, but in order to know how best to reduce the suffering in the world. Without the guidance of scientific studies, our compassion is often blind. The twin commitments to truth and compassion result also in a commitment to equality. Though opinions differ regarding questions of economic and political equality, secular people are fundamentally suspicious of all a priori hierarchies. Suffering is suffering, no matter who experiences it, and knowledge is knowledge, no matter who discovers it. Privileging the experiences or the discoveries of a particular nation, class, or gender is likely to make us both callous and ignorant. Secular people are certainly proud of the uniqueness of their particular nation, country, and culture, but they don't confuse uniqueness with superiority. Therefore, though they acknowledge their special duties toward their nation and their country, secular people don't think these duties are exclusive, and they simultaneously acknowledge their duties toward humanity as a whole. We cannot search for the truth and for the way out of suffering without the freedom to think, investigate, and experiment. For that reason, secular people cherish freedom and refrain from investing supreme authority in any text, institution, or leader as the ultimate judge of what's true and what's right. Humans should always retain the freedom to doubt, to check again, to hear a second opinion, to try a different path. Secular people admire Galileo Galilei, who dared to question whether the earth really sits motionless at the center of the universe. They admire the masses of common people who stormed the Bastille in 1789 and brought down the despotic regime of Louis XVI. And they admire Rosa Parks, who had the courage to sit down on a bus seat reserved for white passengers only. It takes a lot of courage to fight biases and oppressive regimes, but it takes even greater courage to admit ignorance and venture into the unknown. Secular education teaches us that if we don't know something, we shouldn't be afraid of acknowledging our ignorance and looking for new evidence. Even if we think we know something, we shouldn't be afraid of doubting our opinions and checking ourselves again. Many people are afraid of the unknown and want clear-cut answers for every question. Fear of the unknown can paralyze us more than any tyrant. People throughout history worried that unless we put all our faith in some set of absolute answers, human society would crumble. In fact, modern history has demonstrated that a society of courageous people willing to admit ignorance and raise difficult questions is usually not just more prosperous, but also more peaceful than societies in which everyone must unquestioningly accept a single answer. People afraid of losing their truth tend to be more violent than people who are used to looking at the world from several different viewpoints. Questions you cannot answer are usually far better for you than answers you cannot question. Finally, secular people cherish responsibility. They don't believe in any higher power that takes care of the world, punishes the wicked, rewards the just, and protects us from famine, plague, or war. Therefore, we flesh and blood mortals must take full responsibility for whatever we do, or don't do. If the world is full of misery, it is our duty to find solutions. Secular people take pride in the immense achievements of modern societies, such as curing epidemics, feeding the hungry, and bringing peace to large parts of the world. We need not credit any divine protector with these achievements. They resulted from humans developing their own knowledge and compassion. Yet, for exactly the same reason, we need to take full responsibility for the crimes and failings of modernity, from genocides to ecological degradation. Instead of praying for miracles, we need to ask what we can do to help. These are the chief values of the secular world. As noted earlier, none of these values is exclusively secular. Jews value the truth. Christians value compassion, Muslims value equality, Hindus value responsibility, and so forth. Secular societies and institutions are happy to acknowledge these links and to embrace religious Jews, Christians, Muslims, and Hindus, provided that when the secular code collides with religious doctrine, the latter gives way. For example, to be accepted into secular society, Orthodox Jews are expected to treat non-Jews as their equal. Christians should avoid burning heretics at the stake, Muslims must respect freedom of expression, and Hindus have to relinquish caste-based discrimination. In contrast, there is no expectation that religious people should deny God or abandon traditional rites and rituals. The secular world judges people on the basis of their behavior rather than their favorite clothes and ceremonies. A person can follow the most bizarre sectarian dress code and practice the strangest of religious ceremonies, yet act out of a deep commitment to the core secular values. There are plenty of Jewish scientists, Christian environmentalists, Muslim feminists, and Hindu human rights activists. If they are loyal to scientific truth, to compassion, to equality, and to freedom, they are full members of the secular world. And there is absolutely no reason to demand that they take off their yarmulkes, crosses, hijabs, or tilakas. For similar reasons, secular education does not mean a negative indoctrination that teaches kids not to believe in God and not to take part in any religious ceremonies. Rather, secular education teaches children to distinguish truth from belief, to develop compassion for all suffering beings, to appreciate the wisdom and experiences of all the earth's denizens, to think freely without fearing the unknown, and to take responsibility for their actions and for the world as a whole. Was Stalin secular? It is therefore groundless to criticize secularism for lacking ethical commitments or social responsibility. In fact, the main problem with secularism is just the opposite. It probably sets the ethical bar too high. Most people just cannot live up to such a demanding code, and large societies cannot be run on the basis of the open-ended quest for truth and compassion. Especially in times of emergency, such as war or economic crisis, societies must act promptly and forcefully, even if they are not sure what is the truth and what is the most compassionate thing to do. They need clear guidelines, catchy slogans, and inspiring battle cries. Since it is difficult to send soldiers into battle or impose radical economic reforms in the name of doubtful conjectures, secular movements repeatedly mutate into dogmatic creeds. For example, Karl Marx began by claiming that all religions were oppressive frauds, and he encouraged his followers to investigate for themselves the true nature of the global order. In the following decades, the pressures of revolution and war hardened Marxism, and by the time of Stalin, the official line of the Soviet Communist Party said that because the global order was too complicated for ordinary people to understand, it was best to always trust the wisdom of the party and do whatever it told you to do, even when it orchestrated the imprisonment and extermination of tens of millions of innocent people. It might look ugly, but, as party ideologues never got tired of explaining, revolution isn't a picnic, and if you want an omelette, you need to break a few eggs. Whether one should view Stalin as a secular leader is therefore a matter of how we define secularism. If we use the minimalist, negative definition, secular people don't believe in God, then Stalin was definitely secular. If we use a positive definition, secular people reject all unscientific dogmas and are committed to truth, compassion, and freedom, then Marx was a secular luminary, and Stalin was anything but. He was the prophet of the godless but extremely dogmatic religion of Stalinism. Stalinism is not an isolated example. On the other side of the political spectrum, capitalism, too, began as a very open-minded scientific theory, but gradually solidified into a dogma. Many capitalists keep repeating the mantra, free markets and economic growth, irrespective of realities on the ground. No matter what awful consequences occasionally result from modernization, industrialization, or privatization, capitalist true believers dismiss them as mere growing pains and promise that everything will be made good through a bit more growth. Middle-of-the-road liberal Democrats have been more loyal to the secular pursuit of truth and compassion, but even they sometimes abandon it in favor of comforting dogmas. When confronted by the mess of brutal dictatorships and failed states, liberals often put their unquestioning faith in the awesome ritual of general elections. They fight wars and spend billions in places such as Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Congo in the firm belief that holding general elections will magically turn these places into sunnier versions of Denmark. This despite repeated failures, and despite the fact that even in places with an established tradition of general elections, these rituals occasionally bring to power authoritarian populists and result in nothing grander than majority dictatorships. If you try to question the alleged wisdom of general elections, you won't be sent to the gulag, but you are likely to get a very cold shower of dogmatic abuse. Of course, not all dogmas are equally harmful. Just as some religious beliefs have benefited humanity, so also have some secular dogmas. This is particularly true of the doctrine of human rights. The only place rights exist is in the stories humans invent and tell one another. These stories were enshrined as self-evident dogma during the struggle against religious bigotry and autocratic governments. Though it isn't true that humans have a natural right to life or liberty, belief in this story curbed the power of authoritarian regimes, protected minorities from harm, and safeguarded billions from the worst consequences of poverty and violence. It thereby contributed to the happiness and welfare of humanity probably more than any other doctrine in history. Yet, it is still a dogma, as is Article 19 of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, which says, "Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression." If we understand this as a political demand, everyone should have the right to freedom of opinion. This is perfectly sensible. But if we believe that each and every human being is naturally endowed with a right to freedom of opinion, and that censorship therefore violates some law of nature, we miss the truth about humanity. As long as you define yourself as an individual possessing inalienable natural rights, you will not know who you really are, and you will not understand the historical forces that shaped your society and your own mind, including your belief in natural rights. Such ignorance perhaps mattered little in the 20th century, when people were busy fighting Hitler and Stalin. But it might become fatal in the 21st century, because biotechnology and artificial intelligence now seek to change the very meaning of humanity. If we are committed to the right to life, does that imply we should use biotechnology to overcome death? If we are committed to the right to liberty, should we empower algorithms that decipher and fulfill our hidden desires? If all humans enjoy equal human rights, do superhumans enjoy super rights? Secular people will find it difficult to engage with such questions as long as they are committed to a dogmatic belief in human rights. The dogma of human rights was shaped in previous centuries as a weapon against the Inquisition, the Ancien Régime, the Nazis, and the Ku Klux Klan. It is hardly equipped to deal with superhumans, cyborgs, and superintelligent computers. While human rights movements have developed a very impressive arsenal of arguments and defenses against religious biases and human tyrants, this arsenal hardly protects us against consumerist excesses and technological utopias. Acknowledging the shadow. Secularism should not be equated with Stalinist dogmatism or with the bitter fruits of Western imperialism and runaway industrialization. Yet, it cannot shirk all responsibility for them either. Secular movements and scientific institutions have mesmerized billions with promises to perfect humanity and to utilize the bounty of planet Earth for the benefit of our species. Such promises resulted not just in overcoming plagues and famines, but also in gulags and melting ice caps. You might well argue that this is all the fault of people misunderstanding and distorting the core secular ideals and the true facts of science, and you are absolutely right. But that is a common problem for all influential movements. For example, Christianity has been responsible for great crimes such as the Inquisition, the Crusades, the oppression of native cultures across the world, and the disempowerment of women. A Christian might take offense at this, and retort that all of these crimes resulted from a complete misunderstanding of Christianity. Jesus preached only love, and the Inquisition was based on a horrific distortion of his teachings. We can sympathize with this claim, but it would be a mistake to let Christianity off the hook so easily. Christians, appalled by the Inquisition and by the Crusades, cannot just wash their hands of these atrocities. They should rather ask themselves some very tough questions. How exactly did their religion of love allow itself to be distorted in such a way, and not once, but numerous times? Protestants, who try to blame it all on Catholic fanaticism, are advised to read a book about the behavior of Protestant colonists in Ireland or in North America. Similarly, Marxists should ask themselves what it was about the teachings of Marx that paved the way to the gulag. Scientists should consider how the scientific project lent itself so easily to destabilizing the global ecosystem, and geneticists in particular should take warning from the way the Nazis hijacked Darwinian theories. Every religion, ideology, and creed has its shadow, and no matter which creed you follow, you should acknowledge your shadow and avoid the naive reassurance that it cannot happen to us. Secular science has at least one big advantage over most traditional religions, namely that it is not inherently terrified of its shadow, and it is in principle willing to admit its mistakes and blind spots. If you believe in an absolute truth revealed by a transcendent power, you cannot allow yourself to admit any error, for that would nullify your whole story. But if you believe in a quest for truth by fallible humans, admitting blunders is part of the game. This is also why undogmatic secular movements tend to make relatively modest promises. Aware of their imperfections, they hope to effect small incremental changes, raising the minimum wage by a few dollars or reducing child mortality by a few percentage points. It is the mark of dogmatic ideologies that, due to their excessive self-confidence, they routinely vow the impossible. Their leaders speak all too freely about eternity, purity, and redemption, as if by enacting some law, building some temple, or conquering some piece of territory, they will save the entire world in one grand gesture. As we come to make the most important decisions in the history of life, I personally would trust more in those who admit ignorance than in those who claim infallibility. If you want your religion, ideology, or worldview to lead the world, my first question to you is, what was the biggest mistake your religion, ideology, or worldview committed? What did it get wrong? If you cannot come up with something serious, I, for one, would not trust you. Part 4. Truth. If you feel overwhelmed and confused by the global predicament, you are on the right track. Global processes have become too complicated for any single person to understand. How then can you know the truth about the world and avoid falling victim to propaganda and misinformation? 15. Ignorance. You know less than you think. The preceding chapters surveyed some of the most important problems and developments of the present era, from the overhyped threat of terrorism to the underappreciated threat of technological disruption. If you are left with the nagging feeling that this is too much, that you cannot process it all, you are absolutely right. No person can. In the last few centuries, liberal thought developed immense trust in the rational individual. It depicted individual humans as independent, rational agents, and has made these mythical creatures the basis of modern society. Democracy is founded on the idea that the voter knows best. Free market capitalism believes that the customer is always right, and liberal education teaches students to think for themselves. It is a mistake, however, to put so much trust in the rational individual. Post-colonial and feminist thinkers have pointed out that this rational individual may well be a chauvinistic Western fantasy, glorifying the autonomy and power of upper-class white men. As noted earlier, behavioral economists and evolutionary psychologists have demonstrated that most human decisions are based on emotional reactions and heuristic shortcuts rather than on rational analysis, and that while our emotions and heuristics were perhaps suitable for dealing with life in the Stone Age, they are woefully inadequate in the Silicon Age. Not only rationality, but individuality too is a myth. Humans rarely think for themselves. Rather, we think in groups. Just as it takes a tribe to raise a child, it also takes a tribe to invent a tool, solve a conflict, or cure a disease. No individual knows everything it takes to build a cathedral, an atom bomb, or an aircraft. What gave Homo sapiens an edge over all other animals and turned us into the masters of the planet was not our individual rationality, but our unparalleled ability to think together in large groups. Individual humans know embarrassingly little about the world, and as history has progressed, they have come to know less and less. A hunter-gatherer in the Stone Age knew how to make her own clothes, how to start a fire, how to hunt rabbits, and how to escape lions. We think we know far more today, but as individuals, we actually know far less. We rely on the expertise of others for almost all our needs. In one humbling experiment, people were asked to evaluate how well they understood the workings of an ordinary zipper. Most people confidently replied that they understood zippers very well. After all, they used them all the time. They were then asked to describe in as much detail as possible all the steps involved in the zipper's operation. Most people had no idea. This is what Stephen Sloman and Philip Fernbach have termed the knowledge illusion. We think we know a lot, even though individually we know very little, because we treat knowledge in the minds of others as if it were our own. This is not necessarily bad. Our reliance on groupthink has made us masters of the world, and the knowledge illusion enables us to go through life without being caught in an impossible effort to understand everything ourselves. From an evolutionary perspective, trusting in the knowledge of others has worked extremely well for Homo sapiens. Yet, like many other human